You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on October 25th, 2015 at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, I interview guest Heather R. Andrews on the rush card glitch hurting many of America's poorest consumers. Then, Kelly joins me to discuss a proposal for the postal system to provide banking to low-income people. Finally, we discuss the modern-day significance of a 1945 speech by President Truman. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Ohio is a guest who did a guest piece on arsenalfordemocracy.com, Heather R. Andrews. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and hello.
So what we're going to be talking about today, we're recording this on Sunday, October 25th. We're going to be talking about Russell Simmons' rush card. And this is a card that's been having some difficulties for a lot of folks in the past 2 weeks. As we're recording this, these problems still have not been resolved. So we're going to talk about what this product is and why this sort of so-called glitch is so harmful. And this is what you wrote your article for on arsenalfordemocracy.com. So this started on October 12th, 2015. But let's back up to the beginning in case some folks don't know what this is or haven't heard of it at all, because there hasn't been that much media coverage. First things first, who is Russell Simmons at the heart of it?
Russell Simmons is a hip-hop mogul, founder of Def Jam Records. He also founded the Rush Card in 2003 to empower the unbanked. Basically, his spiel was financial empowerment, giving people a chance to have plastic in their pockets, things like that. So basically, he started a prepaid card and targeted it towards low-income, unbanked people.
So the theory here, as far as he pitched it, and this seems to have been going on for quite a long time before, you know, this particular glitch where people weren't able to access their money. As you said, he's targeting unbanked or underbanked populations. These are people who, you know, either don't have a good enough credit history for conventional lending or credit, or they, you know, geographically, they're in a place that doesn't have a lot of local bank branches. It just has, you know, payday lending and things like that, or check cashing places. And so supposedly, he was pitching this, right, as that it was going to be, you know, inexpensive, that it was going to build your credit, that it was going to save you money on these things. Was any of that true?
No. What one of his famous quotes was that it's very inexpensive. It builds credit. You can transfer your money card to card. You don't have to go to Western Union and spend a fortune. You don't have to get in line at a check cashing place. That is a direct quote from Russell Simmons. He also made claims that this would boost people's credit. You shouldn't have to pay money to access your money. All of those claims have basically been debunked. All of them are untrue. In 2014, Russell Simmons admitted that they were still having problems with FICO, that basically the brush card is not helping credit. His claim that you shouldn't have to pay money to access your money is untrue. His fees are higher than many prepaid debit cards, monthly fees. He even has a $1 transaction fee if you pay as you go. Basically, if you don't pay the monthly fee, you can pay as you go, but it becomes $1 transaction fee and you up to $10. So if you don't have the monthly plan, you can spend up to $10 a month on his debit card. This is higher than any of the prepaid cards.
you also gave the example in this that Walmart, for example, has just a flat fee for check cashing that's $3. So, you know, you're only going to pay $3 for that, whereas you might pay, you know, a dollar per transaction for, you know, a whole bunch of different transactions over the course of a month.
Right. Walmart's check cashing fee is $3. It's a flat fee. Also, their prepaid debit card is $3 per month. And I also want to bring up that I don't know in other areas, but in my particular area in northeastern Ohio, check cashing fees other than Walmart range from $5 to $8. Like, I think it might be 6 to 8 cents on a dollar or something like that. So we're talking an average of $5 to $8 to cash checks. This is still lower than what the Rush Car is charging in monthly service fees.
Now, to some of our listeners, and perhaps maybe even many of our listeners, the difference between, you know, $1, $3, $7, $10 can sometimes seem like spare change, right? Because if someone's, you know, if someone's living a comfortable middle class life, that's a relatively small difference in money. But what we're talking about with this product's clientele is that it was being very aggressively marketed to people who really every single cent mattered every month. Is that correct? Am I understanding that right?
That is correct. Basically, you will never see a Rush Cart commercial on primetime TV between the hours of 8 and 10 on major networks such as ABC, things like that. You will always find these commercials on Black Entertainment Television, are between the hours of daytime television where we're seeing the talk shows and court TV and things like that. So Russell Simmons specifically marketed to what you would think would be low income, will classify as a low income audience as far as who's home during the day, who's watching these networks or this type of TV. So we have to look at that too, as far as his marketing goes.
And that brings us up to the present problem, which is that, as we mentioned at the top, on October 12th, 2015, there was some sort of a software upgrade that was supposedly happening that they completely mishandled on the company's side. And as a result, people, because of this quote-unquote conversion or glitch in the conversion, people were, you know, either locked out completely from their accounts or they would log in and see $0 balances. And this was a problem for many reasons, but especially because many people had put their entire paychecks, you know, directly deposited into these accounts, and then they didn't have access to that. And these are people who, again, every dollar matters. So what are some of the stories that you've been reading about as a result of people not being able to access their money for 2 weeks now at this point?
Well, not only have I been reading about stories of people being completely locked out, which is, they've absolutely been horror stories. I couldn't even imagine some of the things that have been happening to people. I've personally talked to people on the phone or via email or DMs regarding their personal problems. You know, I have a single mother, a single father, and just, you know, somebody that does not have kids but needed their medications. They've been without medications. Well, it's day 14. The last time I spoke to her, which was last night, she had to pawn her engagement ring for her medications. I have a single mom that I spoke to that she had saved money for her son's birthday party. Birthday, which would have been last Monday. And she found out when she went to go buy a present that her son, she was locked out of her card. So now it's been 2 weeks. She's now behind on her rent. She still has not been able to celebrate her son's birthday. She has had to reach out through charities, through Catholic charities. She's put up a GoFundMe page. The single father I spoke to, fortunately, his problem was solved quickly. But then I have to question why, because he also had a story covered by Associated Press. And hours later, he had access to his money. So it's very disheartening that these people, especially these people with kids that aren't able to access their money and they've had no access for 2 weeks. And we're talking multiple paychecks in many of these cases.
What has the company's response been, and what has Russell Simmons' response been? Because he really is like the co-founder of this card and has been heavily promoting it for years, so he's sort of tied up very intimately in this.
Right. Well, I mean, just as I haven't really been to his Facebook page, but just following him on Twitter, he has had very little response. Except for copying, pasting. You know, he's asked people to DM him, which is direct message via Twitter. There have been people that have direct messaged him several times with no response. He's going hours without responding. He's going, you know, today, let's see, his last response was an hour ago. Before that, it was one day ago. So, very little action that we're seeing via social media from Russell Simmons. As far as Rush Card goes, basically they're doing the same as Russell Simmons. They're copying and pasting responses. Not responses, well, I guess updates, I should say. But there are still people you can see all over social media that have not been assisted. As far as Rush Card customer service, they have been very unhelpful. People are on hold for hours. Now people are screenshotting how long they've been on hold with customer service. I saw people be on hold for 2 hours, for 4 hours. Then if they do finally get through, they're either told the systems aren't down, or they're put back on hold while being transferred and then told the systems are down. So for about 14 days, this has been going on. People call customer service and they're not getting any response. Some people are being told that they have to fill out disputes, which will take another 10 days. So the response has been poor, basically.
Now, you mentioned there was an Associated Press article about one guy's story. I found, you know, a Time magazine thing. But for the most part, I mean, a lot of people have had to come to places like my site, arsenalfordemocracy.com, to get any news on this because the major news outlets, you know, just aren't covering it, or they're saying, oh, well, there was a little glitch. That's unfortunate. And then, you know, they basically just take whatever the company says and assume that's true, you know, oh, it's fixed or whatever, and then they move on from it. Or, you know, even the Time magazine thing, that was really only a few paragraphs long. And I contrast this, I think, to, you know, wall-to-wall coverage of when there's like a data breach at a, you know, Bank of America type card, or, you know, some major, you know, card or company has some sort of a data breach that just gets tons of coverage. You know, why is there this such a disparity in the coverage? I mean, I know it's a relatively small number of people that have this card, you know, in the grand scheme of things. I think it's fewer than 2 million. But still, for these people, I mean, some of this is going to be life or death.
Right. I don't have a way to answer that objectively. I really don't. I mean, we look at it in 2007, Rush Card were in the hands of 1.5 million people. Asking why it's not being as covered, we have to look at who these Rush Card holders are. Who has the Rush Card? And I think, you know, it's sad, but it just really comes down to the population of people that do have Rush Card. Because I think if this was Bank of America, Wells Fargo, KeyBank, any of the major financial institutions, this would be looping on CNN or MSNBC. Any way to get this word out, you know, people would be being urged by these big media outlets to cancel their cards, whatnot. But we're having a hard time finding these stories because of the people that it's affecting. I believe that, and as sad as it sounds, that's the only thing I can come up with, because this is major, especially when people's health is affected, people are losing shelter, people are being fired from jobs because they don't have gas to put in their cars to get there. So we do have to look at that, and, you know, that's what it all boils down to me.
for folks who want to read the article, I'll be linking that from the radio episode post on arsenalfordemocracy.com this week. That'll be going up on Wednesday. So if you missed that or want to find out more, you can go there. Heather Andrews, thanks again for stopping by.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Arsenal for Democracy will return in just a moment. We're actually going to be talking more when Kelly gets on the air about the issues of banking in low-income areas and some other possible solutions so we don't run into problems like this. So stick around. We'll have more in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me on the line now from Washington is Kelly. Kelly, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So earlier this hour, I've been talking about the Rush card, the prepaid debit card that's been having all these technical problems and how that has really hurt a lot of people who, you know, every dollar counts for them all month long. And this brings us to this issue, which my guest alluded to, underbanked and unbanked populations in the United States. I believe that we've done a segment on this previously on the show, but I think it was while Kelly was in Guatemala, and I couldn't find how long ago this segment was, so I'm guessing it was at least a year or two ago. But the segment that I think I did previously was actually talking about how countries like India have experimented with similar things, right? There's a much larger population of unbanked and very poor people. They've tried various programs like giving everyone in the country a bank account, right? So, you know, issuing a billion new bank accounts, essentially. And that didn't really seem to do what they were hoping that it would do. A lot of accounts ended up being empty, and, you know, I'm not sure what all the reasons for that were, but, you know, basically that sort of strategy didn't work right away. And in the United States, it's a lot of areas for various reasons, maybe negative, maybe neutral. A lot of major banks don't set up in areas with a lot of low-income populations and or overwhelmingly minority populations. Lots of complicated factors behind that, but that is the reality that we're working around here. So sort of an interesting thing that comes up from time to time, and recently there was an Atlantic article about this that kind of brought it back to my attention, was this idea of, you know, we've got this postal service, which is mandated by the Constitution, can't get rid of it, it's required in the Constitution, but it has had some, you know, fiscal problems. Some of them are not as bad as have been made out to be, but the reality of that is that there is this system that exists all over the country in every community, which has been vital for development in, you know, past periods of American history. And you've got these branches set up in every single community and lots of them. So the question is, can you solve two problems with one solution? Dealing with the lack of banking services, basic banking services, you know, check cashing and things like that, limited lending, maybe small savings accounts. Access to that is a problem in some areas, but you do have this postal service that's in need of some more, you know, things to do. They wouldn't need to be making, you know, hand over fist amounts of money off this, but potentially you could, you know, integrate the two of these together. And so this is not that radical, actually, because according to this article, only about 7% of the world's national postal systems don't offer some kind of bank-like service. And, you know, meanwhile, there's a huge portion of the population that could use access to some sort of banking services. And also, we have done this before in this country. There have been periods where the U.S. Postal Service has had some economic functions besides, you know, mail delivery. So, Kelly, what was your reaction to this article?
My reaction to this article was, that sounds great. I can't believe we're not doing that. Like you alluded to, in India and other parts of the world, there's been a lot of focus on micro lending, particularly, which for those of you that aren't familiar, is the idea that if you lend a small amount of money, typically to women, they can use that money to start businesses and eventually pay you back. And there's definitely some, I think, moral gray area in some of the models that are set up right now, in that they're not serving the people as well as they could be or say they are. So I'm not number one fan of microloans. However, I bring that up because many people believe that the next frontier in banking, not only in the development world, but here in the US, is micro savings. So how do you allow people with very little money in their checking account to still have a checking account, to still start building a savings account, to give them a safe place to keep their money where they're at least earning interest. So micro savings is something that I've been sort of watching on the international scale. And I think that what is proposed here would be a great way to do micro savings at home for people, either because of geography or the amount of money they have. Banking in a traditional bank is not an option. I think USPS offers a great alternative. And I think that I just really like the way you framed it in your post on Arsenal for Democracy, that this really isn't that radical. This is something that a lot of different types of people can get behind. I don't think this is as progressive or socialist as many of Bernie Sanders' propositions. So I hope that people take this seriously and it can become something that more mainstream politicians are discussing, because I think it is a very practical solution to a real problem that exists in this country.
Right. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders because the framing that the Atlantic article used was that, you know, Bernie Sanders is one of the people, of many people, who have proposed this idea. But as you said, this isn't that radical. I mean, literally, this has been done before almost exactly, right? There was a postal savings system for new immigrants and the poor that was established in 1910 by President Taft, and it lasted until 1967. So we've definitely done things like this before. One of the things that this article did not go into depth about was that the U.S. Postal Service has actually been vital in developing sort of rural areas of the country, making it very affordable to send packages. You know, obviously, they were probably taking a loss in some cases on individual deliveries, but it helped people, you know, move into the interior of the country and move to further out because they could still, you know, do mail order for all these things. And then that helped those companies in turn. So a lot of these things, if you provide access to low cost or even free services, maybe they're very minimal profits or almost no profit, right? But it's not a complete bust. You know, you're promoting economic growth and development, and you're helping people out in a major way. And again, as you said, Kelly, this is not like from this some sort of radical tradition. This is from a very sort of American mainline progressive tradition from, you know, the original progressive movement. And I think about a lot of the stuff that happened in the 1930s, and actually I think we're going to talk in our next segment about, you know, even as late as the 1940s, some of the sort of proposals that today somehow seem radical. I think this goes back to what we talked about last week regarding sort of the framing that the Reagan Revolution established, where everything outside of like conservative values and ideas is somehow radical and un-American. But, you know, if you think about various projects, you know, in the 30s and everything, I mean, rural electrification, the Tennessee Valley Authority, all these different things, we had all these, you know, public utilities, publicly owned utilities, cooperative projects, all these different ways that the government could get involved. We still have some of these programs around. I mean, think about flood insurance, right? They have the sort of the national system for flood insurance because all of the private, you know, insurance companies wanted to get out of that business. There's been a lot of areas where the government has stepped in and said, hey, this is, you know, there are certain places where the market seems to be doing fine. I mean, some people might criticize or complain about, you know, Bank of America's various practices at ATMs or whatever, but like there are certain areas where the market is at least doing something at a relatively affordable rate for the majority of people. But then there's these areas of complete market failure where the only options are, you know, these payday lending things and stuff like that. And that I know came up in the discussion that we had whenever it was a year or two ago on Arsenal for Democracy on the radio show here, was this, you know, that you've got this predatory lending, you know, exorbitant, you know, multi-100% interest rates, things like that. You know, the basically giving private companies the ability to garnish wages and, you know, get first claim on money deposited into accounts, all kinds of abusive practices, right? Like people complain about the post office sometimes, but man, mm-hmm. the post office isn't trying to steal your money. Like, it's just not. Yeah. Right. And the post office has been having a lot of fiscal issues, some of them basically enforced upon it by quote unquote fiscal conservatives in Congress, the people who are essentially trying to break all of these federal programs by making them not work properly. One of the things they did with that was they did a like a pension liability thing. I don't know all the details on this, but my understanding of it was they basically said that the Postal Service had to pre-fund 75 years worth of pension liabilities, which I guess is super fiscally prudent, but I mean, that's a pretty huge strain to put on the, you know, on the operation right now, rather than saying, hey, look, we're getting a giant population boom. Did you guys not notice that? I mean, we've got, you know, the millennials are now, I think there are now more millennials than people over 65. I think that milestone happened at the beginning of 2015, if I remember correctly. And then that's not even accounting for the people below the millennials, that whatever we're going to call that generation, that is like enormous. I mean, in 2007 and 2008, the same number of people were born in the United States as were born in 1957, the peak year of the baby boom. Now, obviously, the baby boom was more significant because there was a smaller proportional population at the time. But still, I mean, it had never been matched for another 50 years. Now, look at this. We've got a huge population coming in. So some of these concerns about what's going to happen with the pension system, you know, was maybe a little bit overly hysterical. But they haven't rolled back that provision. So now you're asking the Postal Service to do something that no other company or agency in the world has to do, pre-funding, you know, decades worth of these obligations. So, of course, they're having money problems. So, you know, this is an area where they're not necessarily going to make a killing on it, but that's not the point, right? The point is that for people who really need access to safe, legitimate, non-predatory services in areas where they don't have it, this is a way to get it to them, right?
And I think that one theme that just keeps coming up is how for low-income people in America, there are barriers that are set up by government policies that keep them in poverty. And I think that this lack of a safe savings spot, a safe place to cash your paycheck, is one of the ways in which people are kept in poverty, because a lot of the people who need their checks cashed most, those are the people that these sort of predatory banking companies are taking off a pretty good chunk right off the top just to help them cash that check. So I think that this is a very practical, prudent, sort of low cost, high impact way to start removing one of the barriers exists for those people trying to get themselves out of poverty.
Yeah. One of my online buddies who has sometimes guest contributed on arsenalfordemocracy.com very often uses the phrase, it's very expensive to be poor.
Yes.
Which is this idea that poverty is not just a lack of money, it's a sort of system that enforces that poverty by nickeling and diming you at every single turn. And, you know, one example that he's given before, which is, you know, not the same category as this, but sort of illustrative of that phrase, is the idea that, like, well, you can buy a really expensive, high quality boot that's gonna, you know, pair of boots that's gonna really get you through the winter and all the rainstorms and everything, and it's not gonna fall apart. And that's, you know, a quote unquote, a better investment than some cheaper pair of boots. But if you don't have the money on hand to get the more expensive pair, you have to get the pair that's going to fall apart and then get it again, you know, get a new set, right? And so you end up spending more, but you don't have that money available when you're actually needing to make the purchase. And that was something that came up in the last segment with my guest, Heather Andrews, was this idea that, you know, if you're solidly middle class, if you're looking at something like the Rush card, the prepaid debit card, and they say something as simple as, well, you can pay, you know, $7.95 flat fee for unlimited transactions, or you can pay, you know, $1 per transaction up to $10 a month. You know, a solidly middle class person with no money issues to speak of really is going to look at that and go, wait, $7.95 versus $10 a month? Like, it's not a substantial difference at all, right? That's what they're going to look at that and say. But if you're someone who does not have $7.95 on hand at the beginning of the month to pay that flat fee, you're going to opt to pay the $1 per transaction up to $10. And, you know, then, you know, you spend two extra dollars a month, which, again, doesn't seem like a lot if you're not coming from a perspective where every single penny counts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think that we need to tackle these obstacles at any given turn and start maybe taking some of this low-hanging fruit. And this suggestion seems to be common sense, seems to be something that would be a pretty easy and powerful fix for a lot of people. So I hope to see this idea stay in the spotlight and continue to get traction with all political candidates.
All right. Stick around, folks. Kelly and I will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. We're going to be talking, of all things, about President Truman's administration and what that might tell us about American politics in 2015 and 2016. So stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me from Washington is Kelly. We're going to be talking now about a post that I put together on October 17th at arsenalfordemocracy.com. Title of this was 13 of Truman's 21 policy points from 1945 are relevant today. So I looked at a speech. I forget how I even got onto this topic, but I looked at a speech that President Harry S. Truman gave to Congress right after the end of World War II. I mean, this was like a matter of days after VJ Day. And he had 21 points very clearly outlined, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? It wasn't like people had to sift through with a magnifying glass and figure out what these were. This was literally special message to Congress presenting a 21-point program for the reconversion period. And so he gave this on September 6th, 1945. And I went through this. I was curious to see what points he had presented. This wasn't even when he was running for, you know, re-election in 1948. This was just in 1945. They hadn't even had the 1946 midterm elections, which ended up being won by the opposition party, the Republicans. Now, some of these things are not really relevant to our discussion today, right? They're things like, you know, selling battleships or recollecting money lent to Britain for various things that were super specific to World War II. But a lot of these things were sort of more general economic principles. They weren't just, you know, wartime rations must be rolled back by X percentage and currency controls must be, you know, these are things that were more general economic principles for sort of the general overarching future of the United States. Or they are things that are related to the war, but could also relate to the recent wars that the U.S. has been engaged in the present day. So the points that I identified as being sort of relevant here were, one, unemployment compensation, right? Because they were basically talking about how there was going to be a whole bunch of layoffs because they were spinning down the sort of wartime operations at the factories and everything. Two, Fair Labor Standards Act, basically trying to make sure that people are still getting treated fairly by their employers and have various collective bargaining rights and everything. The next one, which was number five, was the goal of full employment. Six, which is really interesting for 1945, fair employment. I think that is especially relevant today. At the time, he was primarily talking about things like race and religion, but I think we would, today's context would be like the equivalent would be trying to get the Federal Non-Discrimination Act for LGBT employees. Number seven was harmonious industrial labor relations, basically talking about trying to avoid strikes, but also making sure that there are fair solutions so that it doesn't get to that point. The next point, number eight, was job creation for returning veterans and in regions where job opportunities are scarce. That's a very relevant problem today. We've got folks coming back from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. And then we've also got a problem of needing to match the sort of unemployed populations with where there are job creations happening. And this sort of ties back to our last segment. You know, it can be very expensive to move. If you don't have savings on hand to be able to make that move, you can't get to the place where the job is. The ninth point was sustainable agriculture. There were some other things I think thrown in there as well, but that was sort of the one that I pulled out as being still relevant today. The jumping to the 11th point, housing for all, urban and rural, and socially responsible city planning. That was sort of an interesting thing that he put in there, kind of talking about the need to, you know, rebuild sort of decaying urban areas, but also in a responsible and fair manner that doesn't just throw people out on the street. I think that's relevant today in the context of the debates on gentrification. Number 12, support for research, academic, industrial, and governmental. 13, responsible tax policy, matching revenues to expenditure needs, balancing the burden distribution. So not just cutting taxes or raising taxes, but making sure that when you need to raise taxes, you do raise taxes. And when you do raise taxes, it's on the right people. Jumping to point 15, support for small business, always relevant. Number 16, support for returning veterans in all arenas of their life. So that was basically what led to the GI Bill and, you know, health care and things like that for veterans, the VA system, what we now call the VA system. So that's still relevant. And then 17, this was the last point that I identified of the 21 as being still relevant today, investment in public works and conservation of natural resources. So Kelly, of these points, what struck you the most?
The first thing that jumped out at me right away was, oh, this could totally be a platform for any of the candidates running today. It goes to show that we have faced the same obstacles, the same problems for quite some time. And so we need to sort of reflect on history and use that and not reinvent the wheel every 2 or 4 years. One thing that struck me as being especially forward thinking was actually the support for research and how that the important role that government has played in the past decades when it comes to scientific research and how we need to sort of reinvigorate our commitment to that as we move forward when it comes to things like NASA and funding drug research and drug innovation and all the ways that science has improved our life in the past decades. Fortunately, not enough people know what a big role the government played in that and how they really enabled a lot of those researchers to do their job. And of course, all of the employment, the bullets pointing towards full and fair employment is especially relevant as we come out of this recession and we see that some have bounced back better than others. And that is largely owing to the family that they were born into. So really recommitting ourselves to the society where everybody gets a fair shot and where you can earn a living for your family by putting in your 40-hour work week and working hard. Those are the things that jumped out the most to me.
Like you said, I agree this also could just basically be used as a platform for a Democrat running in 2016. I don't think anyone's going to use it, but man, they could. And the thing that I sort of thought about is, like, some of these, honestly, as we talked about last segment, they are now framed as radical ideas. And these are so mainstream in the time period that we're talking about. I mean, and that was, yeah, World War II and the immediate post-war period was sort of a bizarre, sort of exceptional period in American history. And you can't necessarily cross-apply everything. But like I said, I took out the points that are really the exceptional ones. The other points still are very relevant to this time period today. It's sort of remarkable how far we've drifted away from it. I mean, this one, I don't even think included his subsequent call for a universal healthcare system. Like, this is so mainline that it doesn't even include that, which is now seen as totally, you know, totally out there at this point. These are just really, really basic ideas. Hey, guys, we should have full employment. Hey, guys, we should have sustainable agriculture. Hey, guys, we should conserve our natural resources in a responsible manner. The other thing that is really obvious through here, right? I mean, you've got obviously the point about supporting small businesses. That, as I said, is still relevant. But you were pointing out the research side and the government role in this. But he specifically highlights there's three different areas: academic research, industrial research, and direct governmental research. And he put them all in the same point, saying, hey, these are all like, you know, three legs of the stool or whatever. I don't think he used that phrase, but that was sort of the concept that he was going for, that you can't really have one without the other in any effective sense. And that's why I think this is so mainline and not radical, as has been argued, is that this is not a, you know, super right-wing proposal. It's not a super left-wing proposal. It's for 1945, this really is middle of the road. This is finding a third way between actual socialism and, you know, total laissez-faire 1920s style free market capitalism. And this is saying, look, there's a role to play in bridging sort of different areas of our society. You know, the private sector, the public sector, you know, other various elements of civil society, things like that. This is a way of coming together and just getting the job done, right? So in some cases, you want to support a company's research efforts because companies are effective at certain things. In some areas, they're not very effective or it's not that cost effective. So you want to have the government step in, or you want to give a grant to a university to do it. This sort of applies through most of these points, is that there is a way of doing this that is not anti-capitalist, but it's also, you know, not unbridled capitalism. It's a mixture that reasonably looks at the situation that we're in and says, hey, how are we going to get this done most effectively?
Absolutely. And I also just really appreciate the way he laid out the 21 points. And they're so clear exactly what he wants. And I do wish more platforms sort of looked like this.
Right.
The bullets and the, you know, being really clear about his vision for America, and that employment takes up quite a few of those bullet points. And that's what he valued in his America and wanted to get the country to.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, you brought up the sort of the way the speech is written. Some people have criticized, I think probably correctly in large part, criticized the fact that he essentially said, because he was had just come from the Senate, right? This was about 6 months into even being out of the Senate, right? So he spent several months in the vice president's role, or maybe it was about 9 months at this point, I'm not sure. You know, so he spent, I think, 3 months or so as vice president, and then he was the president for about 6 months at this point. But he had come from the Senate, so he was thinking of it from sort of a legislative perspective as a legislator himself. So he didn't present like specific bills or anything. He sort of assumed that Congress would just take it from there, right? That he would lay out the roadmap and then they would present him with bills to sign. And it didn't really work out like that. So a lot of this didn't come to fruition. I mean, some of it eventually did, you know, the stuff that was very, very specific to the war and sort of winding down the war effort, that pretty much did happen. But some of the sort of bigger picture things did not happen. But on the other hand, you know, what you said is that he is laying out very clearly this roadmap, these points of this is what needs to happen. And also the speech is filled with examples of him demonstrating why this is necessary, not getting into, you know, X percentage and Y percentage, or, you know, Z dollars and that kind of thing. He's laying these things out in broad terms, in broad principles, not just tying it specifically to the war, but making a case for things. To give an example of something that was war related, but just sort of to illustrate the way that he constructed this speech, he had a provision explaining a need for full conscription or continued conscription, right? So this was basically not stopping the draft. And the obvious reason is, well, we're not sure if their war is really over for sure yet. You know, something could immediately break out again. Or you could say, oh, they just wanted to keep a gigantic military or whatever. But he makes a more pragmatic case, which was as simple as if you are graduating high school in, you know, like say you just graduated high school in May of 1945, right before the war ends, and you were about to get called up in the fall to go serve, and then suddenly the war's over. If they let you just immediately go into the workforce, that's going to be really unfair to the guys who have been serving for, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 years or however long actively in the war. You know, and they need to have sort of first crack at the job market in the short term, right? The, you know, the first couple of years when there's this difficult adjustment between really high sort of job levels for the war effort and then really low job levels because the, you know, war effort is ending, but the economy hasn't come back to a normal state, and then back again to where there's enough jobs for everyone. And so his idea was, okay, here's the theory, and then here's how we would implement this to deal with this theory, and then this is why we should do it, right? So it's a way of logically laying out steps that I think some Democrats have sort of not done as well in many recent years. Rather than, you know, giving sort of the principle and theory of something, they just either buy into the existing sort of Reagan-esque framework, or they just get too deep into, like, you know, I heard a story from a single mom named such and such in New Mexico, and she told me that this, and that leads us to this, you know, 25% whatever, 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 right? They don't lay out the sort of overall case for something. Is that, was that your kind of take on it as well?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it is an issue, a challenge for all presidents to sort of border. I mean, the fact is that presidents can't, you know, propose specific legislation. And so a president's job as sort of a manager and visionary setting out these big bullet points with also definitely needing to make the pragmatic case and lay out specifics so that senators and congressmen can really get behind what they're saying. And I think that that is a very fine line, and one that few presidents have done particularly well, is balancing that vision and sort of being the big idea guy and, you know, respecting the job of the Senate and the House to sort of be the lawmakers, while at the same time recognizing that there is a degree of specificity and details that need to be used in order to move forward and, you know, build your case for the country and for the lawmakers.
That's going to bring us to the end of this segment and this week. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this Truman speech and also the topic of low-income banking in the United States.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.